Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you all, albeit virtually, today. I just want to maybe start with a reference to a Polish writer from the 1950s, Czesław Miłosz, there's an echo. I'm sorry, I'm going to turn down the sound on my end. Who wrote a very fascinating book. It's called The Captive Mind, where he explores the effects of Stalinism on public intellectuals. Basically, he says, in particular, that in order to win the acknowledgement of their citizens, people's democracies wage a struggle over the human mind.
Excuse me, Nadezhda, I think there's a big echo. So if you can switch all your, I don't know, if you have a Facebook open somewhere or the synopsis of a page or something or any other. No,
no, everything is turned off.
So for some reason there is echo. I will check your I will switch the mute to this participant as well. So now let's try. Is it better?
Okay, is it still echoing or?
No, it's perfect now.
Okay.
Please.
I can hear my voice, which is disturbing too. There's an echo. So I'm going to turn the sound down. I'm sorry about that. Sorry about that. Okay, so back to Miłosz. So he wrote that people's democracies wage a struggle over the human mind, and people need to be ushered to understanding, and once they understand, they will accept the totalitarian regime. This is a trait that all totalitarian regimes share. They want to keep the mind captive of the ruler's version of the truth and trying to compel its people to accept and internalize it so deeply that individuals will eventually believe that it's a mistake to doubt or oppose the state's version of the truth. Of course, it's one thing to try to elicit this kind of acceptance at home, but it's much more complicated to do it on the international stage and to nurture a good reputation and to gain this approval of your system or of your regime on the international stage, especially when you ambition, like the PRC today, to take central stage in the world, to become a leader on the global stage. So how do you manage this perception abroad? How do you manage to be accepted when you're a one-party state? And I think the two-day conference that Synopsis organized really gave us some clues about the how China is trying to do so. You unveiled the importance of the United Front work in this particular task, the deployment of para-diplomatic activities that rely on a range of tactics and proxies and actors and entities that are rooted in Leninist ideas. The work that you have done and presented over the last 2 days, I think, reveal one key aspect of the objectives of such efforts, which is trying to shape the discourse, trying to engineer a landscape that's favorable to the CCP to the CCP itself, to the CCP's policy, and also engineer a perception of global support for the CCP system and its policies as well. And that's an essential piece of the puzzle that you've been studying for the last 2 days. And it's an essential component of the CCP's efforts abroad. You also have revealed and underlined the diversity and the variety of instruments that have that are being used, as well as the wide scope of these activities. What I want to do is to spend just a few minutes to talk about one tiny little segment of this very complex effort, And that's China's use of think tanks as platforms for this discourse engineering and this effort to present the party state as an acceptable actor on the global stage. First, of course, it seems that there's a contradiction in term here, because when we in the West, when we think about think tanks, we think about organizations that are supposed to be generating research, analysis, and ideas that are independent of the government. They're supposed to be completely disconnected and able to have an, as far as possible, an objective appreciation for the events, so that they can recommend specific policies to the government. So how is that even possible? How is it even possible to have think tanks in a country that is ruled by a one-party state, where the party endeavors to control every aspect of society and policy? Well, the PRC is not very different from other authoritarian powers that have all recognized quite early on the utility or the usefulness of think tanks and research centers, not just to inform their own decision making, but also as a way internally or domestically to give a false impression of plurality of opinion at home. So when you have different research centers, you have experts, they can go on TV, or they can write papers that give an impression of diversity of opinion that is very that reinforces the legitimacy of the party at home and gives for the population this false sense of variety or diversity. But equally important to the regime is also the usefulness of those think tanks as conduits for the formation, dissemination, and persuasion of public opinion, again, at home, but also internationally. And as in many other domains, Xi Jinping's arrival to power marks an acceleration, a clarification, a shift into the importance of those think tanks for the regime. The development of think tanks in China builds on an academic tradition that has been long developed in the shadow of the states. You know, like in Soviet Union, in the Soviet Union, in China, research centers have been long, I mean, since the 50s, they've been attached to the CCP or to the state bureaucracy, to committees or ministries or security agencies. And traditionally, I mean, neither Mao nor Deng Xiaoping ever really used them. They didn't rely on them to inform their own decision making. There's the beginning of a change around with Hu Jintao's arrival to power, because as a former president of the Central Party School, he recognized the interest in having inputs from Chinese intellectuals and experts to help inform his decision making. He invited several of them to Politburo study sessions, for example. And around 2008, 2009, with the global financial crisis, there's a sudden surge in the creation of several new think tanks in China, including some that will be very familiar to our United Front specialists, like the Center for China and Globalization and the Chahar Institute. They are both dedicated to international relation and specifically economic issues. In December 2012, Xi Jinping at the CCP Economic Work Conference says he wants to establish high quality think tanks to serve policymaking. So it's the same idea as with his predecessor, but as always with Xi Jinping, it's the same ideas from his predecessors, but it's accelerated and he gives focus to many of those policies. The third plenum of November 2013 passes a resolution to create a new types of think tanks with Chinese characteristics, and that becomes the label for this new accelerated policy that the party wants to encourage the creation of this new type of think tank. So what does it mean exactly? Well, it means in effect tighten government and party controls over those structures. They're restricting foreign fundings. They're demanding that each think tank be placed under the purview of the party state as part of the dual management system. Basically, think tanks are like media. Their name has to be party. They're supposed to be instruments serving the policies of the party state. As Fu Ying writes, for example, think tanks should adhere to the party leadership and serve the country. So the definition of their mission is very clear from the beginning. They're supposed to serve the policy of the party state, and in particular, they have this very clearly defined role of helping and expanding China's discourse power and international influence. Other authoritarians, again, are basically doing the same as China, Russia, and some countries in the Gulf are sort of having the same trend of wanting to develop those think tanks. But what's really interesting and unique about China is, first of all, the scope of its international efforts, and specifically towards the developing countries. There's a global effort going on here to engage with think tanks around the world and try to shape their perceptions. And the second thing I think that really stands out is how systematic and methodological these efforts are. And in particular, this systematic effort is visible through the development of international think tank alliances under the Belt and Road banner. So the role of these think tank alliances has been described as thought producers, policy promoters, public opinion guides, information disseminators, and consensus aggregators around BRI. The thing with the BRI is that it helps us really see in a very, I wouldn't say confined, because BRI is so big and has ramifications everywhere, but it helps us to delineate more easily some of China's efforts in the foreign policy and around the world. And really through this prism, you can start to see patterns emerging. And here it's quite clear that the role of Chinese think tanks that participate in those Belt and Road alliances is really about, again, shaping the environment, shaping the opinions, shaping the perceptions of others in a way that's favorable to BRI. So there's a few alliances that are mostly created around the auspices of the CCP, of the Central Committee's International Liaison Department, most of them created around 2015. The Belt and Road International Think Tank Cooperation Alliance, the Silk Road Think Tank Network, the Belt and Road Studies Networks, the University Alliance of the Silk Road, and a couple of others. All of them acknowledge as their main purpose not the creation of knowledge and original research, but the need to serve the development of the BRI. So again, there are entities that are created for a political and geopolitical purpose. So why are they important, and what function do they serve? First of all, when you're a think tank, just like in a democratic country, you can organize public conferences, events, you publish research, you share your analysis on media or on public platform. And what Chinese think tanks are doing when they do that is proactively set the agenda in a very specific direction. And as they do that, there are some topics that are not discussed, and the discussion is kept within boundaries that are acceptable for the party state, and that are basically just within the party line. Some voices are ignored, so there are entire segments of the discussion that are censored, and there's no alternative point of views proposed within those either conferences or publications. So there's only the party line that will be disseminated. Interestingly too, I think this is also part of a broader pattern that we have observed elsewhere, is that because there are so many of them, they can saturate the public discussion. And this has a greater chance to be achieved specifically in countries where there is little or no expertise available locally. So when you don't have local experts who can maybe propose this alternative perspective on events or on policies that are proposed by the party, then usually representatives of Chinese think tanks take the entire space, and they just propose their own version of the truth. Obviously, the role of United Front proxies is extremely important in the deployment of those relationships. When you look at the list of countries and foreign governments that fund think tanks in the US, for example, you will not find the PRC. The Chinese government does not fund foreign think tanks, or especially U.S. ones. It's easier to research on the U.S. ones because they're usually more transparent than others. But the funders are usually foundations or prominent businessmen or tycoons who are doing this work of funding programs or think tanks abroad. Of course, we know very well a very old friend of ours, Patrick Ho, whose think tank, the China Energy Fund Committee, has done a lot of that. He has sponsored many events and programs in DC, in Washington, DC. There's the China-US Exchange Foundation, and his president, Tong Chih-hua, who is the vice chair of the CCPCC, and the former Hong Kong chief executive, who has also, his foundation has funded China-related events and programs in several think tanks in the U.S., such as Brookings, CSIS, the Atlantic Council, etc. So, again, not specifically the PRC government or CCP per se, but going through those proxies of prominent rich businessmen who have foundations or unlimited funds to help develop those programs that are related to China. It's the think tanks also have a very interesting function for the party state, which is the creation or the nurturing of networks. If you nurture good relations with think tankers around the world, that could, you know, influence in the ultimately it becomes a very interesting way to influence again the perception that those people have of your country, of your policy, of your regime. And especially in the US, where many think tanks operate on the basis of what is called the revolving door, which is officials when they're not in the administration go back into the think tank world, become experts or commentators there, and wait to go back to government when their administration or their party is back in power. Then indirectly, if you're nurturing those relationships, you're also nurturing relationships with potentially people who are extremely close to policy circles and who can ultimately influence the decision making of your country, of the target country in the end. So that's really important in the way that China is operating or using those think tanks. Finally, China has a couple of implants in foreign countries. In April 2015, they have created and launched in Washington, D.C., the Institute for China-America Studies. Since its creation, it has kept a very low profile. There's not so much going on in terms of public events or even publications from this particular think tank. The other one that seems to be more active is the Budapest-based China CEE Institute that was created in April 2017. And they seem to have been much more proactive in publishing, papers and reports that would be presenting China and the Belt and Road in particular in a very positive way. So just to wrap up, when we study China's efforts to expand its influence abroad through the use of party state proxies, think tanks are really a key element of that effort. It's a key instrument in China's overseas influence and propaganda efforts. It has really been identified as important tools to help improve its international image, to help project the party's ideas and policies abroad, to shape the discursive space, all in the while trying to, again, help with this idea of having the party system and policies accepted throughout the world. So with that, I would stop, and I'm looking forward to our discussions. Thanks for your attention.